This is an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Today's topic is hyponatremia in pituitary patients, and Dr. Lewis Blevins will be discussing that particular disorder and how relevant it might be in your particular disease state and across the spectrum of different managements in patients with pituitary disease. Welcome, Dr. Blevins.
Good morning, Jorge. It's a pleasure to talk with you again about a very important topic to patients with pituitary disorders, that being hyponatremia. And let's start with the basics. So what is hyponatremia? Well, that's a term used to describe a low serum sodium level. Sodium is an ion that's the first part of sodium chloride in salt. It's very important for our bodies. It plays a number of different roles within cells and in the bloodstream to do all sorts of things, and that's well beyond the scope of this podcast. We measure sodium in milliequivalents per liter, and that liter refers to a liter of water. 70% of our bodies are water, so this is an important ion when it's distributed throughout 70% of our body water, and then also in our cells and in bone and things like that. So it's a critical ion. The amount of it that constitutes our weight, I don't know, but it's fairly significant. And when you have derangements of serum sodium, bad things can happen.
So how do you get low sodium? How does that come about?
Serum sodium, very simply, results from either excess water in the body, the bloodstream, the fluids between the cells, the fluids in the cells, for example, where people are simply waterlogged is one way to think about it. So instead of maybe 70% for men or 65% for women of our body weight being water, maybe that's increased another 5 to 10% or even 3%, for example. Another way that one can end up with a low serum sodium is to have salt losses, and there are a number of different disorders that can lead to salt loss that we'll talk about a little later.
Okay, then. So what's the problem? So what if your sodium is not normal?
Jorge, that's a great question. When the sodium level falls for one reason or another, first off, if you're losing salt, you get very dehydrated as well. Even though you have a low sodium, you can be markedly dehydrated and volume depleted. But sodium is very important, and sodium concentration very important for the all cellular processes to function normally, in particular muscle, but especially the central nervous system and the peripheral nerves for nerve conduction. Water is something that crosses all cell membranes, so whatever the water content is in the bloodstream, usually it's the same in all cells. So if you have a water excess state, for example, all the cells in your liver and your kidneys and your thyroid or whatever get bigger because they have more water in them, and water is distributed evenly across those cell membranes. The real problem, however, is the brain is in a fixed-sized cranial vault. So when you get extra water in the glial cells and the nerve cells in the brain swells, but it has nowhere to go. The liver can expand in your abdomen freely, but the brain can't expand inside your cranial vault. And that cerebral edema can be very life-threatening when the brain starts compressing itself because it's swelling and parts of the brain start what we call herniating to areas where they're not supposed to be, and that can result in clinical symptoms and signs. In fact, some of the earliest symptoms and signs are headache. Someone might have a flu-like illness, some nausea, vomiting, and that can progress to confusion, obtundation, seizures, coma, and even death. So it's a real serious problem to have hyponatremia.
In general, how common is hyponatremia?
Interestingly, it's said that 2 to 3% of people have hyponatremia on hospital admission. Rates can be as high as 27% in some series when they look at all serum sodium levels obtained. where, you know, any serum sodium level that's low, as many as 27% of sodiums in hospitalized patients are abnormal. Interestingly, most people hospitalized acquire hyponatremia in the hospital as a response to their disease process or treatments they're receiving for their underlying disease. And we'll talk about some of the frequencies of hyponatremia in pituitary patients a little later.
As I hear you talk, I wonder how complex is the physiology that regulates sodium, what factors are involved, and why can this be seen in pituitary patients?
Jorge, the principal regulator of water composition of the body is arginine vasopressin, which is produced in the hypothalamic area of the brain and stored in the posterior pituitary. So there you go. The pituitary is the seat of all of this. Arginine vasopressin circulates. It's released in response to changes in osmolarity. It circulates. It acts on the kidney and causes the kidney to hold on to more water. So if you have a disorder that secretes excessive amounts of vasopressin for whatever reason, and there are lots of them, you can end up becoming water intoxicated, waterlogged, whatever term you want to use, with hyponatremia and some of those symptoms and signs that we mentioned earlier. Interestingly, however, cortisol also is involved here. So cortisol suppresses vasopressin gene transcription. People with adrenal insufficiency might actually have hyponatremia because they don't have cortisol to suppress vasopressin, so they make more vasopressin at a certain level of osmolarity. The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, which is complex and involves the kidney, the lungs, and then again the kidney and the adrenal glands, regulates salt balance as well and intravascular volume, so that deficiencies of aldosterone or a low renin state for whatever reason can result in hyponatremia. These patients usually have salt losses, however. It's believed that thyroid hormone affects water regulation and the free water clearance at the level of the kidney in patients with very severe primary hypothyroidism, such as having had thyroid surgery or severe Hashimoto's, may actually end up with hyponatremia as well. The heart and the brain are involved in making natriuretic peptides that get rid of too much salt if that's on board. And then lastly, the autonomic nervous system integrates a lot of this input into the hypothalamus, receiving information from baroreceptors and stretch receptors in the aorta, for example, and they regulate the release of vasopressin in response to blood volume and blood pressure, and they regulate the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system and also play a role in atrial natriuretic peptide release by the heart. So really, and I just thought of this, your whole body is, essentially your whole body is involved in regulation of salt and water composition. So the pituitary, the thyroid, the kidneys in several ways, the lungs, the liver, which makes some of the enzymes that are involved in the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, the adrenal glands, the brain, the heart, the autonomic nervous system. So everything has to work right for your serum sodium to be normal. And, you know, interestingly, if you have a normal serum sodium, you're probably doing okay. The bottom line is all of these systems work together to tightly regulate our serum sodium concentration so that our bodies work normally. And it's an interesting situation that sort of takes into account the water in and the water out, and it makes certain that we are not retaining too much water and that we conserve water when necessary.
Boy, that sounds so complex, but at the same time so interesting. It's just amazing how everything must be in balance and work together. I presume things go haywire when things start going out of balance. So, very interesting. Can you talk about the specific situations regarding hyponatremia in pituitary patients so our listeners can be aware of how they might be at risk and how to understand their particular situations and what sorts of treatments might be required if they develop hyponatremia?
Jorge, there are several different subsets or categories of patients who are at risk for hyponatremia. Let's start with those who have pituitary adenomas. So in our institution at UCSF, we've actually done the research on this, and we know that about 3% of our patients who present with pituitary adenomas will have hyponatremia. And we believe that most of the time this is related to cortisol deficiency or central adrenal insufficiency as a consequence of pituitary dysfunction related to the tumor. hypothyroidism may be contributing to some extent, but usually the hypothyroidism of hypopituitarism is not as severe as having had your thyroid removed, so it's unusual that that would be contributing. I have seen patients with hypernatremia and otherwise normal pituitary function and believe that they may actually have SIDH, and a couple of those patients have actually had tumors of the posterior pituitary, so that makes a little bit of sense. So then it's possible to have hyponatremia due to pituitary tumor upon presentation, and when that happens, the first thing that patients and physicians should think about is, are my adrenal glands working? Is the pituitary sending enough ACTH to the adrenals to keep cortisol levels normal? Interestingly, in these patients, when we treat with cortisol in the form of hydrocortisone or even low-dose dexamethasone, the hyponatremia resolves in 2 days.
So it's really critical to be on top of that, since it sounds like it's fairly easy to resolve once you know what's going on.
And then the next group would be those patients who've had surgery for Cushing's disease. And studies have showed that it's about 20 to 30% of patients with Cushing's disease may be at risk to develop hyponatremia after surgery. We believe this might be related to relative adrenal insufficiency, because a patient with Cushing's has very high cortisol levels. If they're rendered disease-free, their cortisol levels fall, and they have a relative cortisol deficiency, which might lead to more vasopressin secretion, but we're not entirely sure. There may also be some tweaking of the posterior pituitary, which then dumps vasopressin and causes the hyponatremia. Usually the hyponatremia occurs by day 2 to 5. Sometimes, since patients are now discharged from the hospital after a couple of days after pituitary surgery, the hyponatremia may present itself at home. So it's important to anticipate that that might be a problem and look for symptoms and signs, namely those that I mentioned earlier: headache, flu-like symptoms, nausea, vomiting, etc. Those symptoms certainly should prompt a call to the physician's office and a trip to the emergency room or the local laboratory to get a serum sodium level checked. Treatment is usually a slight bump in the steroid doses, but most often fluid restriction. And if it's severe, we would use medication, as to be discussed later.
Wow, I never heard of that. Do you see that?
Yes, I don't think we see it in 20 to 30% of our patients, as has been reported in the literature, but we do see it a couple of times a year. The most important thing is that we know it can happen and we're aware of it so that we can get on it really quickly should that problem occur. I might add that the other situation where Cushing's patients are at risk is those who've had adrenalectomy for refractory Cushing's disease, and they then require mineralocorticoid, otherwise known as Florinef, which is a replacement for aldosterone, and also cortisol. And so you can have either cortisol deficiency or aldosterone deficiency there, leading to hyponatremia in occasional patients until the doses of their medication are adjusted to titrate to their needs. Another subset of those patients with pituitary disease at risk for hyponatremia include those who have undergone pituitary surgery. In our center, we found that 16% of patients who have had pituitary surgery develop postoperative hyponatremia. This number has been as high as 30 to 40% in some series, so we may be missing some patients if it's really that common, or we may just simply have better surgeons who can stay away from the posterior pituitary and not cause this problem. It's hard to say. We believe that this is a disorder that results from release of vasopressin in an unregulated fashion from the posterior pituitary after manipulation during surgery, or maybe even some vascular injury to the posterior pituitary, who knows. But at any rate, the excess vasopressin causes retention of water at the level of the kidney, and over a period of days, this can sort of accumulate and cause hyponatremia with symptoms. Most of the time, it occurs within the first 7 days after surgery, and in our experience, probably day 5 would be the most common occurrence, but we've seen it as late as a month out from surgery. And again, awareness of the problem, educating patients to report for evaluation should they have those symptoms, being suspicious of hypernatremia is the key to early diagnosis and then successful treatment. Interestingly, the hyponatremia may occur alone and then resolve, or it may be preceded by a period of diabetes insipidus, and then followed by either normal salt and water metabolism or recurrent diabetes insipidus. That latter phase where we have, or latter situation where we have three phases, such as diabetes insipidus, SIDH, and then normal or diabetes insipidus is called the triple phase response. And because of this, every patient that I see who has hyponatremia after surgery, I suspect that they may have diabetes insipidus afterwards. Most don't, but occasional ones do. And it's just important, again, as a physician, to be on the lookout, and I encourage my patients to be on the lookout as well. And by the way, this is far and away the most common cause of hyponatremia in patients with pituitary disorders. Some of the things that I've learned is it's important to evaluate whether I'm seeing the patient in the initiation phase of the SIDH or whether it's sort of been ongoing or whether it's resolved and we're just dealing with the fact that the serum sodium is low, and whether it's acute or chronic. And all of those factors play a role in decision-making regarding treatment. If it's chronic, for example, fluid restriction is probably the best way to go. And chronic would be if we don't know the duration or if the patient has no symptoms at all but a markedly low sodium, that's a sign that their brain has volume adapted, and it's probably chronic. Fluid restriction historically and when we have to do it can take 5 to 10 days depending on the degree of the water retention and how long the SIDH goes on. I've seen patients require hospitalization for 10 days for this to resolve. If the hyponatremia is acute and very severe with seizures, etc., we would treat a patient with a 3% saline infusion. If it's moderate, with moderate symptoms, we would usually use a Vaptan medication, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And if it's very, very mild with a sodium 128 or higher, we might even just use fluid restriction in that patient. So I mentioned the Vaptans. That's an interesting class of drugs, and they basically block the actions of vasopressin at the level of the kidney. And there are two drugs that can be used. Conavaptan is a drug that's available for IV administration and is used mostly in the hospital setting and in particular in the ICU. And then tolvaptan is an oral medication that can be used in the hospital and then, if necessary, at home for up to 30 days. Interestingly, our patients who require Vaptan therapies, regardless of which drug we use, require it for about 1 to 2 days in the hospital. It's rare to have a patient require more than 3 days, and it's unusual for a patient to require it at home. However, I have had patients, I remember one with pituitary apoplexy of a tumor after a carotid dissection that resulted from a fall. He had hyponatremia for about 3 months and required tolvaptan for that length of time. The really wonderful thing about the Vaptans is that the old way of treating patients with postoperative hyponatremia required hospitalization for 7 to 10 days. We published some of our research with Conavaptan and showed that on average, I believe it was about a hospitalization duration of 36 hours with no recurrent hyponatremia after treatment. And we certainly see that with both Conavaptan and Tolvaptan in our practice. As far as my assessment of unpublished results of treatment. Unfortunately, the Vaptan drugs are not always available. I had a recent patient who developed postoperative hyponatremia at a hospital 5 hours away from our institution, and that hospital did not carry the drug, nor would they be able to get either of the drugs available for about 5 days. So this patient has now been in the hospital about 7 days waiting for her hyponatremia to resolve. It's unfortunate that the hospital didn't carry the medication because she would have been in the hospital probably no more than 36 hours had she been able to receive treatment.
Well, you'd think that every hospital would have every possible medication and things that like that wouldn't happen today, but I guess they still do. So anyway, this is so fascinating and so informational.
Well, the next group of patients with pituitary diseases at risk for hyponatremia include those with diabetes insipidus who are treated with DDAVP. And you can develop hyponatremia either due to excessive vasopressin dosing or excessive water intake. And what I've seen in the past is people who want to go on diet, so they drink extra water even though they're taking vasopressin. And with the drug on board, you're going to withhold all that water into the bloodstream and not let it out. A normal person would shut off vasopressin and extrude that water from their body through the urinary tract. But the risk of having diabetes insipidus is that you have a fixed dose of vasopressin that you can't shut off. So the water you drink in is going to stay in until the drug wears off. I've seen people go to fraternity parties and drink too much beer and develop hyponatremia while taking DDAVP. So water intake is critical, and managing that appropriately is important if you have diabetes insipidus. The real danger, however, comes in treatment, and the gut reaction of most physicians when this happens is to stop the vasopressin and fluid restrict the patient. And this can lead to a marked and rapid quick rise in serum sodium that can be very dangerous and lead to a problem called central demyelination. So the key to therapy is to give DDAVP when the polyuria starts back, because that tells you the drug has worn off. And then you control the rate of rise of sodium. I've been known to give DDAVP in small doses or even aqueous vasopressin subcutaneously, even though the sodium is low, because the polyuria is back, and I know that sodium is going to rocket upwards as that patient starts losing body water. So we have to control the rate of rise of sodium. And if we overshoot, sometimes we have to give water back to keep that sodium down a little bit. But the critical thing is to let the patient drink in response to thirst. The problem is if the DDAVP wears off and the patient becomes polyuric and the sodium rises and they don't lift the fluid restriction, then the patient's going to become profoundly dehydrated. So if you have diabetes insipidus and you develop hyponatremia, you need to work with a physician who understands how to give the dose back when the drug wears off, and also to lift your fluid restriction so that you drink when you're thirsty to avoid the rapid rise in sodium. Now, I've seen them go from 104 to 165 in a 24-hour period and lead to brain injury because of that rapid rise. So it's a critical thing to know that you have to work with a physician who knows what's going on. And if you're a self-actualized patient with diabetes insipidus and you take DDAVP, read as much of this as you can, because you may be instructing the physician on the best appropriate management for your particular disorder.
So I hope this podcast will lead many patients who are at risk to make sure their physicians understand their mechanisms, understand the mechanisms of this condition. That is great, really. You related before that there are lots of causes of hyponatremia, and I imagine patients with pituitary disorders can get hyponatremia not related to their pituitary disorders. Am I thinking about this correctly?
Well, yes, indeed, Jorge. In fact, patients with pituitary disorders can develop SIADH or salt losses and lead to hyponatremia. That's totally unrelated to their pituitary disorders. There are a lot of different causes of hypernatremia, including tumors that secrete vasopressin, with lung cancer being a common one. Hypernatremia due to SIDH can occur in patients with pneumonia and sepsis. Any central nervous system problem can result in hypernatremia. There are a lot of different drugs, including seizure drugs and antidepressants, as well as thiazide diuretics like hydrochlorothiazide, that can cause drug-induced hypernatremia. And then patients can have adrenal insufficiency or drugs that can cause salt losing in the level of the kidney. Patients can have heart failure, cirrhosis of the liver, or renal failure that also leads to hyponatremia. So that's one of the things that we do in a patient who has pituitary disease and hyponatremia. We don't just make the assumption that their disorder is related to pituitary disease or one of the hormones produced by the pituitary, but we have to consider the whole physiology of the body and all the health and medications issues that are facing this particular patient before we make that assumption. And that's the role of the physician in evaluation and management of patients with hyponatremia.
Well, thank you for going through these so very complex things and making it so easy to follow and for all of us to understand. I am sure it's going to help many of our listeners as they tackle these complex disorders.
Jorge, it's been my pleasure. That was a whirlwind tour. I could talk about hyponatremia for days, I know this is a relatively short podcast and acts as an introduction, but hopefully it's enough of one to inform and empower our listeners and readership to understand hyponatremia, how it might affect them, and educate their physicians when it does, and take better care of themselves.
Thank you, Dr. Blevins.
As always, it's a pleasure to chat. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.
You've been listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.